Today, we're thankful to have Beth Hemsworth with us back again. And one thing I wanted to mention about her, I know I always introduce her as the 10 talent woman, because she is, but I wanted to make sure you are aware of that she has done parenting classes here at Xenos, and they were recorded, and they are at our study center. If you ever want to use that resource, check it out. It's called Parenting for a New Generation. So Beth always gives us something to think about, and I'm sure today is no exception. So today it's, how does my child's moral compass impact relationships? So let me pray, and we'll have Beth start. God, everybody's coming from different things this morning. Sometimes it's hard just to get out of the house, and I thank you that all these parents are here today. So I just really pray you'll help us set aside all those distractions and stresses of the day and focus on what we've got going here today. And I just pray for Beth that you will speak through her to encourage all these parents here. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Kim. Well, I'm excited to be back here. This is one of my favorite things to do every year, partly because I think that being a parent is about the most challenging role, at least that I've ever taken on in life. When I worked as an ICU nurse, I thought that was really exciting and challenging and pushed me to the limits of my capabilities, and then I became a mom. Wow. I found out that there is something that's even harder because it's not the professional thing and you don't walk away from it. And you guys already know that. But it's so wonderful that we can have this community because it lightens the load incredibly when we can walk this thing together. And there are also a lot of ideas and attitudes and things that we can interact with that also make it a whole lot easier. Because I know that in my life, the things that made parenting difficult or stressful for me mostly were misunderstandings about how people work or misunderstandings about what children need. I grew up in a family that had a lot of relational conflicts and difficulties. So I truly believed of myself that I didn't know how to love a child and that even if I felt it in my own heart that the child would not perceive it. And I would, you know, sit and cry by my child's crib because I just knew that I wouldn't be able to show how much I love. And then I read this silly little book that had been sitting on my bookshelf for over a year because I didn't read it because it had such a silly title called How to Really Love Your Child. And I thought, how can you put that in a little book like this? But it had such simple and engaging advice. It said basically what a child needs is eye contact, focused attention, oh, I'm not just doing the dishes while they're talking to me, and physical affection. And I thought, oh, I can do that. It's just not that hard. So sometimes I have found that the most scary parts of parenting, when we just get a little more information and a little help from our friends, can really be a whole lot easier. Well, the series that I've been bringing to Care Group over the last several years, I've been basing on an idea that I'm just calling moral compass. Because I think that we all need to have some kind of a paradigm or some kind of just a way of approaching an idea that we can remember and that we can take to our kids. Because I think it's not a bad idea to bring to our kids and say, hey, you know, you have a moral compass inside of you, and let's talk about the different parts of that compass. So it's just an easy way to look at things. Today we're going to talk about engagement and about relationships, but I want to quickly go around the compass just so we remember what each of the compass points is about. North is God as our ultimate reference point. When we think about north on the compass, it's not in your handout, but if you think about north on the compass, you're basically thinking about, you know, our identity, the vision we have of being a part of God's long work through humanity, the security that we have in the love of God and in the way he works in our life. Those things are our north. And also in north is our conscience. It's one of the things that knits us to God and provides that north orientation. Okay, east is engagement, and it's about the fact that we were created to connect. You know, above all else, the Bible is profoundly a relational book. The Bible is about how God values us as human beings, how he created us and said, ah, it is good, and how he wants to bring us back into a relationship and heal the fallenness that each of us experiences. And I think it's important for us to realize that all moral development depends on empathy. And if you want to read a really cool book about parenting, which is really not so much about parenting, but about child development, it's called The Moral Child. And it goes into this idea that teaching kids right and wrong and giving them a bunch of rules and expectations is really not a great way to get them to do the right things. So much more important is helping them to develop a heart of empathy towards other people. Because when you care about someone, you're not going to hurt them. When you care about someone, you're going to want to protect them. And so much better that we develop empathy in our children than that we just tell them what to do. All right, that's a little bit about East. South is the one we don't like to look at, but becomes a part of our life for all of us, and that is suffering, trials. And how we define suffering matters. And suffering is really different from one person to the other in terms of how we perceive it. It's not today's topic, but it's something that you can go back and look online if you're interested in this topic through those care group, the Xenos online care group. You'll find one on that. And I would say also about suffering that how we face it may be one of the most important gifts we ever give to our children, because they will experience trials and difficulties, and knowing how to deal with that is pretty important. West is about wealth and work. We are made in the image of God, and God is a creative worker kind of guy. It's about making provision for ourselves and others, and it's about how we deal with material and materialism. So those are just kind of the points of the compass, just to get an idea of where we are today on this. And today we're going to look at the compass point East. As I've already said, the Bible is profoundly a relational book. You know, one of my favorite passages, which of course is the favorite passage of the Hallmark greeting card as well, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Wow, now if I looked at that as the standard, the rule book, the things I have to do, I would be super overwhelmed. Because I don't, in my own ability, I can't do those things. But what Paul is talking about here, he's not saying these are the rules for how you act with people. He's saying this is the definition of love. Love is, not you have to be, love is all of these wonderful things. And it means then that as we look at God, we look at the heart of God, oh, that's what God is. And that's how he relates to us. And it gives us kind of a way to take a step back in a deep breath and say, oh, it's not a rule book that I have to follow, but it's a relationship that I can enter into, a relationship that I can deepen in and become more like. So what is the essence of morality? When we look at that word, morality, it sounds so Victorian, but what is the essence of it? One of those simple, complicated questions. What is morality?
Knowing right and wrong.
Okay, I think that's a huge element of morality. Morality involves the conscience, which is knowing within ourselves what's right and what's wrong. Morality, we could sum up all of morality in love. Love is the essence of morality. When Jesus said, what is the most important commandment? He said that you love each other, love one another. And so morality is all about how human beings treat one another, how human beings apply justice, how human beings help one another come to an understanding of and a living out of right and wrong. Okay. And what makes us able to treat other people well is that deep connection with God. And that's why we put this topic of engagement as a part of the whole moral compass. It's not just that we have to do engagement, but we do it because we're connected Northway with God. All right, what we're going to talk about today is the idea of relational resilience versus the supermodel emotional life. Okay, relational resilience is all about this idea that I am able to maintain a healthy sense of who I am, even if I'm in conflict or if I'm hurt by somebody or if I'm slighted by another person. Relational resilience is, I come to care group, and I say something stupid, and I feel like I've bombed, you know, and somebody criticizes me, and I go home, and, you know. Relational resilience is the ability to say, okay, this happened. I, you know, It's people still like me. I call my friends up. I tell them what happened. I get some comfort, some support, and I move on. It doesn't, like, totally blow my day. It doesn't make me say, oh, I'm never going to do that again, and those sorts of things. That's relational resilience. We kind of get up, and we pick up, and we move on again, and we learn something from it and do better the next time. Well, the supermodel life, I listen to NPR a lot because I'm an artist, and I spend a lot of time in my studio making art by myself. And one of the speakers they had on recently talked about the supermodel emotional life. And I thought, what a captivating idea. But we now have, through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all the social media we have, we get this idea that everybody else's life is beautiful. And everybody else's life is smooth and calm and affluent and gorgeous. And you have teenagers taking like 1,000 selfies before they get exactly the right look that they're going to post on their Facebook. And somehow, because of all the movies and the things that we like to watch and the things that we like to read, we've gotten the idea that normal is beautiful, normal is conflict-free, normal is I define who I am, I follow my heart, and my life explodes into this extravaganza of wonderful living where I'm completely fulfilled and, you know, all that stuff. Happily ever after. That's like the new version of my generation's happily ever after. Does that make sense? We have this idea, this supermodel idea, that life is going to be perfect. And when it is not perfect, when my supermodel life is not working, and I've been hurt, I've been in conflict, this is a very, very bad and catastrophic thing. And it generates a lot of anxiety. And anything related to conflict or anything that conflicts with my idea of my supermodel life should be avoided, or I should get compensated for it. Is this making sense? Does it ring a little bit of a bell with how we see things? And it's so helpful for us to take a step back and say, wait a minute, that's not real life. Real life is, you know, I get acne. Real life is I have conflict with my brother. Real life is my husband got laid off. You know, and real life is the way that is the place that our children are going to live. And it's the place that they're going to inhabit when they grow up. So let's get them ready for real life skills. And sometimes we need to just take a step back and realize some of the things I'm doing with my kids might be preparing them more for the supermodel life than for the life of emotional resilience. So we're going to look at three things today related to this. One of them is hurt versus harm. The second one is resilience versus reactivity. We'll look at those ideas. And the third one is feelings and reality. It's not feelings versus reality in this one, but it's feelings and reality. Because we need both of them, but we've got to get them in balance. All right, hurt versus harm. Let's go there. Okay, hurt is when we experience pain, obviously. We're going to cope much better with hurt when we know that it's something short-term and that's not really damaging. And without revealing any names, a young mom called me a few years ago and said that her son was crying and crying and crying because he had colic. And it was a very distressing event. I mean, I remember those years and how horrible it is. You feel really, really upset when your baby's crying and you know that they're in pain. And the pain is real and the pain is legitimate. It's not like you can just say, oh, go to sleep, it's no big deal, because it is a big deal. You know, to that child in that moment. That child is hurting. But the thing that was important to be able to say is, oh yeah, it hurts, but it's not harming your child. It's just gas. It will dissipate. The pain is being caused by stretched nerve endings in the intestine. It will go away. When it goes away, no long-term harm will be done. And it kind of takes it takes some of the stress out of a situation to know that even though we hurt, we're not being harmed. You know, it's going to go away, and when it does, nothing lasting will have happened. So there's hurt versus harm. Another thing about hurt, that from a more adult perspective, my husband had to have an emergency appendectomy a number of years ago, and it was fairly dramatic with the ER experience and all that kind of thing. But when he came out of it, he was like, hey, you know, I'm doing pretty well. Got this taken care of, got this under control. And I was like, dude, just want to let you know, from a nursing perspective here, fifth day post-op, you're going to feel terrible. Oh, no, no, I'm fine, you know. So he's, you know, motoring through and coming home from the hospital, and I want to get up and walk around. And on the fifth day, he woke up and thought he was going to die. And he has used this story over the years many times to be able to say, Oh, then I remembered that my wife said that on the fifth day it would be the worst day post-op, and that the next day I would be better. So I was okay to hunker down and suffer through the fifth day because I knew that day six was going to come along. That's hurt. We hurt, and it's real. But when we have hope, and when we know what to expect, and we know it's not really causing long-term damage, we can kind of relax the anxiety about the pain that we experience. And it happens in the emotional realm as well. If three young kids are out playing together and the youngest one is always getting bossed, is always getting left out of the action or ignored by the other kids, that kid is going to be angry, he's going to be frustrated, he's going to be crying, and he's going to be hurt. Okay, I think we've all seen this happen. But what is the difference? When does hurt cross over the line into being harmful for that child's life? And that's what I want to talk about a little bit. And when we get into our discussion groups, we can talk about it more. But give me your ideas. Is there something, okay, the kid's hurt, he's having a bad day, but frankly, when he's 14, he's not going to remember that day. What would be the difference between hurting and actually being harmed so that when he is 14, he's brought something negative out of it? Any thoughts about that? Okay, if it's something repetitive, that would be an aspect of it. What else?
Probably his parents' response to it.
Oh, his parents' response to it. I'm sorry?
Could help him, you know, or make it worse. Mm-hmm. Like if the parent tries to, you know, encourage him that you're going to be okay and, you know, tries to, I don't know, just help him to bounce back from it better.
Yeah. Okay, so when the parent's reaction in the long term is going to make a difference, how am I helping that child to interpret what has happened to him? What is he learning about what has happened to him? And like you said, if the parents are being able to say, you know, okay, why it's happening perhaps, and legitimize that he feels bad, but not let him interpret it in really negative ways, that's going to make an enormous difference. The thing that actually turns hurt into harm is that when a painful experience becomes harmful, harm is forming the negative attitudes. When they become self-protective because of it, when they become bitter and they think that it's okay to be bitter, when they accumulate shame and think I'm just not as good as the other kids, of course they leave me out because I'm bad, and those sorts of things. Or when they have unrealistic expectations that carry into their adult life and relationships. If the mom comes in and says, oh, they can't treat you like that, that's terrible, and how could they do that, and you deserve better than this, and we're just going to go to Cup of Joe and get a smoothie instead because you deserve to have a good day. I'm trying to be culturally relevant because I used to take my kids to McDonald's for an ice cream cone. But anyway, that's going to cause actual harm because we're setting up the expectation that our child has to be compensated for these things, and that it's really, really bad, as opposed to that it's just a thing. All right. We're going to get to how could we maybe address this in just a minute, but I want to bring up another example. I know a girl who, when she was in kindergarten, went to an assembly, and they were all sitting, you know, in rows on the floor watching some presentation. I don't remember what it was, but the parents were in the back, you know, oh, isn't this cute, and my kids get to perform, and we were having a good day. But I noticed, I was there, and I noticed that one of the girls sitting on the floor punched a girl sitting in front of her. And I thought, what on earth? I mean, it was a really, you know, it was clearly an aggressive thing. It was not a playful, you could just tell by the look on her face. And the girl in front of her turned around, and you could see that they had a brief exchange. And I really wondered what on earth could have happened. And so I talked to the girl that got punched afterwards. I said, hey, you know, what was going on there? Why did that girl hit you? And she said, what she said was, she hit me because she said she wasn't as pretty as I am. She was angry because she wasn't as pretty as me, so she hit me. And I thought, wow. One of the children in this exchange is hurt because she's been punched in the back by another kid. One of the kids in this exchange has been harmed. Which one of them has been harmed? The one that hit her, yeah. I would be so much more concerned about the life of the one that hit the girl than the girl that got hit. Yeah, because with the girl that got hit, you can explain, okay, this is crazy, and, you know, talk a little bit about the realities of kids and jealousies and things like that. But for the one who's so angry and so bottled up that she would sock another child who she perceived to be prettier than her, that's real harm. Laura's laughing over there. I'm trying to leave names out of this, dear. Okay. Oh, you punched her? Okay. All right. You know, it's just so beautiful to be in a group where we grow up together. My home church has people from 30 to 72 in it, and little kids and old kids, and being able to be with you guys for another generation of these things is just such a sweet experience, that kind of continuity thing. It's really wonderful. All right, so it is not the experience itself that is harmful. It really isn't. Even when our kids are really, really hurting, when they're crying profusely, when they really feel pain, it's real. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's harming their life in any way. It may mean, I mean, it's all about how we process it. Most of our conflicts will be long forgotten. What matters are the attitudes and the perceptions that remain from those conflicts. So how about these three kids? Two of them are being mean and one is crying. It is like what would be likely to produce harm in that situation would be if the parents intervened by saying, "Stop being such a sissy," or "What's your problem?" or "Just get in there, come on, get in there and show them that you can play with them too." Or just like, "Oh, just let it go. If you don't want to play with them, just go play someplace else." Those would all be things that would help kids to develop either an aggressive or a self-protective kind of a stance about these kind of conflicts. So what can you do instead? You got these three kids playing. One of them keeps getting left out. And I would begin by saying that you don't do anything most of the time, but only if it becomes a consistent thing. I mean, if it's a one-off event, it's just not that big a deal. We should expect our kids to be able to kind of shake those things off and keep moving. But if it becomes a thing, you know, where every time these three kids get together to play, or in other groups of kids when they're playing, then it clearly can be a problem. And so I think the first thing that a parent who wants to intervene, who assesses that this is a moment that it's worthwhile intervening, needs to do is to call those kids together and to clearly identify the problem. Clearly identify the problem. What is the problem? Well, the problem is that these two guys are 5 and this little guy is 3. And this little guy doesn't have the same skills as these guys. And it just kind of helps to kind of walk them through, hey, you know, the problem here is that this one is littler and this one doesn't know how to play in the same ways. And so you may not realize it, but you're really hurting his feelings by leaving him out. So let's find a way to do things together. So then we can create compromises, because what we don't want to have happen is that the big kids label the little kid a pest, or that the little kid gets the idea that he's always left out or always dismissed or whatever. And we create compromises to address the selfish behavior on both sides, because of course the little one's going to get mad and he's going to be kicking the big ones. So, you know, there's stuff to address on both sides. So I would just say that normal rough and tumble is good for them. But look for patterns and attitudes. And it's the patterns and attitudes that we want to address with our kids, not just the day in, day out conflicts. Because if we felt like we had to intervene in every conflict in which our child felt hurt, we would spend our entire day doing play police, and it just wouldn't be effective at all. It would be it's in those, you know, rambling around and conflicts that they have that they learn all the social skills that they need. All right, that's hurt versus harm. And we're going fairly fast through these because we want to have some time to discuss in our small groups, and I have some questions for us to discuss about them. Resilience versus reactivity. How other people respond to my circumstances or to my experiences teaches me how to respond. Okay, so again, if something is happening and my child has been hurt by somebody, and I'm all defensive and angry on behalf of my child, it teaches him that the right response to being offended is to be angry and to want to make it right and get justice and all that kind of thing. So how we respond to them, it makes an enormous difference. So, and I also would say that we're always developing either maturity for engagement or a habit of self-protection. When our kids are growing up, they're going to learn to become more and more engaged and able to overcome obstacles to engagement, or they're going to be learning to become self-protective and wanting to get away from engagement. We all know that we look to others to help interpret our experience, and the classic example of that is the toddler who's running up and falls flat on his face. What is the first thing this kid does? You're nodding. What does he do?
He looks at you.
He looks at mom and says, "Am I hurt? Is this bad?" And if mom says, "Oh, come on, are you okay? Are you okay?" You know, or just says, "Oh, too bad," then usually the kid will just get up and keep on motoring along unless they're seriously hurt. But if mom, you know, swoops in and, "Oh my God, I can't believe you fell," you know, then the crying is usually quite amplified. Well, that idea relates to the kinds of things that our kids face in every area of life and in every developmental stage, and even for us today as adults. If I have a bad day and I tell my friend all about it, and she says, "Wow, that's really a bummer," you know, and just kind of like, but doesn't make a big deal out of it, just lets me vent, maybe it gives me a little bit of sage wisdom, I can move on. But if my friend is, "I can't believe she treated you that way, and I blah, blah, blah," and we soon get into gossip, "Well, yeah, she always does that, and I heard blah, blah, blah," and we all know where that goes. So for all of us, this feedback thing is really important to developing either resilience or reactivity. All right, let's think. I think we've defined a little bit about resilience. It's that ability to kind of get back, to move back into relationships. But what is reactivity? If it's different than resilience, what is reactivity, you think? Doing in the moment what feels like the right thing to do. That is exactly right. It's just that automatic, instant response that bypasses the brain. Have you ever had that experience? We're going to move into, really quickly now, into feelings and reality. But this is the whole idea here, is that reactivity is when I just automatically react to something, start to do something, only because I've kind of been triggered in an emotional habit. You know, we all have emotional habits. And we trigger into them without even thinking about them. And one of the goals with our children and with ourselves is to increase the threshold for reaction. In other words, it should take more to trigger a negative reaction in us as we mature. When I was 20 years old, I could trigger into anxiety a lot faster than I do now. Now I can have life experiences and life circumstances. You know, my husband just lost a contract, and that's half of our income for the year, and like, okay, you know, that's happened before. We don't get all reactive about it anymore. We're able to say, okay, we've got some life experience, we've seen how God takes care of us, and so on and so on. But that's trying to increase our threshold level to react before we have to react, feel like we have to react to something. Does that make sense? Reactivity? Anybody who took biology knows that it's all about, you know, how much electrical stimulation does it take to make the frog's leg jerk, you know, and all that kind of craziness. I don't know if you guys do that in biology anymore. It was really a hoot when I did it. All right. Let's go on to feelings and reality. But, oh, here's this lady going, ah! How we respond to our children or others helps them form their expectations and their sense of what is normal. Feelings and reality. Here's one of the hardest things for human beings all over the planet to grasp and believe and act on, and that is that our feelings don't define reality. It's true. Our feelings don't define reality. It sounds like it's a very simple kind of little fact. We can just put it out there. But in the moment when we're reacting, we feel like what's happening inside of us, it's so real, it's so present, it's so immediate, we think it defines reality. And so I want to say that feelings are real, but feelings are not reality. And this is a hard thing that I've really had to learn and struggle with for my whole life. I'm an extremely melancholy person from a long family of depressed people. And if I lived my life on the basis of how I happen to feel in any given day, I would not do anything. And I think that probably I'm seeing a few nods here and there. I'm probably not the only one in the room who wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if the only thing that we defined as the reality of our life were how we feel about things. And it sounds like a harsh thing. When I put up feelings and reality, that's why I didn't say feelings versus reality. because it's not versus reality. Our feelings are real. They are legitimate. They are a God-given way for us to interact with the environment that we have around us. But we need to understand and realize that our feelings are just as broken as every other aspect of our life, and just as likely to be manipulated or likely to be to come out in ways that don't conform with reality. And it's a hard life lesson to learn, I really believe, but it's one of the most foundational ways that we can move towards maturity, is to realize that our feelings don't define reality. Have you ever had the experience of being really, really stressed and upset about something, and you just feel like it's a disaster, and you finally just give up and go to bed, and then you get up the next day, and you look at exactly the same circumstances, exactly the same reality, but your feelings are different? What happened? What happened? My body got some rest. My brain disconnected for a little while. I came back to it, and I was able to look at it through different eyes. And we really see this in spades with little kids. You know, they're hungry, or they're tired, or whatever, and everything gets blown out of proportion. So feelings don't define reality, and it's super helpful for us to be able to teach our kids that from an early age. I understand why you feel that way. I feel that way, too, lots of times. I just want you to understand that you feel this way, but the reality is this. I know that you just said, "Mommy, I hate you." I know you feel like you hate me, but I don't really think that you do, you know, or whatever. You know, there are a lot of different things that kids say based on feelings, and we don't have to have an existential argument with them every time about what reality is and all that, but we need to help them learn in their calm moments that those excess, those big feelings that overwhelm them are feelings. They're not reality. All right, thoughts and beliefs, on the other hand, if you think something, or if you believe something, or if you have a philosophy about something, it requires that you think it over. There's a meditative aspect to it. So we can often appeal to our kids and their interpretation of life by helping them think differently about things. And I find that trying to help a kid think differently about something when they're upset is really pointless. You know, there's nothing to be gained by trying to help reorient a child's attitudes in the moment that they're upset. But when that moment is passed, there's a great time to be able to sit down and to say, "You know, you had that amazing fight with your brother or your sister or your neighbor or me, you know, and I wonder, and let's just talk about what were you thinking, or what is the thinking behind that, or how could we think differently to avoid that?" And it's really amazing how kids are able to process and think when they're not in that moment of emotion. So our feelings are our emotional reactions to what we perceive reality to be. But once we get a clearer perception of what reality is, then we're able to have different feelings about it. For instance, if you're working and you have somebody at work who always makes you feel stupid, or always makes you feel like you're not doing a good enough job, or always makes you feel, I'm already saying this, like makes you feel. They don't actually make you feel, but they act in a certain way that you respond that way. Sometimes, if you can just get to know that person, you can find out more things about their life and about the way that they relate to other people, and you can say, "Oh, she's not mad at me. She's not rejecting me. She's got these issues in her life, and this is the way she acts towards everybody. So how does that impact how I feel at work?" It takes a big load off, because I know that it's not a personal thing. And that's an example of how knowing the reality about something helps to change our feelings and helps to change our reactivity to it. Is that making sense? Yeah, I don't know if I can do one more example. My kids had a school teacher who was really, really difficult to deal with. And because we were living 1,000 miles up the Amazon, we didn't have a lot of options about what teachers were available. And this lady was harsh. She was very demanding. She didn't mind humiliating people. "Whose paper is this? Who turned in this paper without having their name on it? Well, you, it's yours. You did it again." You know, and then she'd walk off. I mean, you'd hear these stories every day and just think, "My word." So, but there weren't a lot of options. So what do you do? And the kids are sad, and they're legitimately feeling hurt by some of the things that go on in this classroom. So you sit down and talk. Okay, how do we think about this person? Well, this person is lonely. an American person who married a poor Brazilian who now lives a life that economically is way lower than any of the people that she interacts with. She's got horrible social skills. She clearly comes from a family where she's super shy, and somehow she reacts these ways. But look at the way she watches you on the playground. She watches you like a hawk. Nothing bad will ever happen to you when she's out there watching you, because I see her, and I see her knowing where every kid is. I see her coming into school early and grading all those papers and making all that stuff, and she cares about, she'll come and talk to me if you didn't do your homework. She cares about your advancement and things like that. Now let's have her over for lunch. Let's get to know this person as a person. And I wouldn't say that she stopped doing crazy things in class or she stopped being difficult, but I think that the experience of being in that class was made better because reality supplemented the feelings. Is this making sense? So when we get some reality, it makes a huge difference. So we need to understand the emotion of our children, but engage and challenge the thinking that underpins the emotion, to help them to learn that emotions are real and powerful, but that they are not the way to define what is real. The emotions are real, but they may not reflect reality. So what has all this got to do with a moral compass anyway? Moral compass, engagement, point E on the moral compass. Because we can't treat people ethically. We can't treat people compassionately if our own emotions are out of control. We can't be that person. We can't love the people around us without understanding these ideas of hurt versus harm and resilience and what do I have and how to have appropriate expectations of life and that kind of thing. So it makes a big difference. And as an exercise for parents, I think it would be interesting to write down a few examples of times that you were depressed or angry or anxious in these moments, and that you later felt a certain well-being in yourself, even though those circumstances didn't change. And what happened in between? How did I go from anxious, frustrated, depressed, angry, to calm, accepting, able to think it through, and able to respond appropriately when the circumstances are exactly the same? And I would say for most of us, it's probably we got some sleep, we had a candy bar, or didn't have a candy bar, depending on how we react to sugar. But we talked to a friend. We talked to God. We had some positive time with somebody else. And so those are the kinds of things then that we look to for our kids. We don't just automatically say, oh, you're hurt, you feel bad, oh, I'm going to make you feel better. But rather, you know, let's get some sleep, let's get some food, let's get some objectivity, let's talk through, let's think about how life really works. All right, I'm going to throw open for some questions while we're all together. And then we have three discussion questions that come with each of these areas. Discussion question one is, what examples have I seen of hurt versus harm? And how can I help see to it that hurt does not produce harm relationally? The next discussion question is, how do my reactions to my child's painful experiences help to form their life expectations? And another question is, what are some situations in which my feelings have changed significantly without a change in situation, and how did that happen? So when we break up into groups, these are the things we're going to look at. But before we do that, are there any thoughts or questions that we want to throw out? Yeah.
I was going to say how interesting it is when I know my experience, when I've been down or anxious about something, the more I just think about it in my own head, I can really swirl it up into really, it's just overwhelming. But if I sit down and talk with a friend and get it out, and you talk through it, it's amazing that changes the perspective that, okay, this isn't as bad as I thought. But I can convince myself that it's all falling apart. So just that community is so important for, I think, our emotional health. Yeah. And
every human has a built-in blind spot. We don't realize that we are taking things in from our own perspective, and that our own perspective is self-protective in one way or another. And so, yeah, just in my mind anyway, I just can go over and over and over and over again about an experience or about a person or whatever. And it really takes somebody else coming in, even if they don't say anything, but being able to express that and hear myself talk to kind of break that cycle. Yeah?
I have a question on this hurt versus harm stuff. Mm-hmm. I have, obviously you know this, but two rowdy boys, and we're always having more boys on play dates, and the neighbors come over, and then there's like eight boys all of a sudden. and tackling and wrestling and stuff and mm-hmm. punching and saying mean things. How much do you intervene? How much is over intervening? How much the three, you know, us moms are always sitting on the porch like, oh, is that something we should do? Is this not? And when I over intervene, I'm reactive and you guys need to stop doing this. But how do you just stay out of a lot of it?
I think that's a really super important question because that's the day in and day out of where we live. I don't know if this perspective helps a whole lot, but frankly, this is the first generation that has had the luxury of being able to be there and the thinking that I need to intervene for everything because my child is going to be hurt. You know, when I was growing up, we just ran out and played, and none of our parents knew where we were. Well, they knew basically where we were, but they certainly were not there when we had these mean, tough interactions. And some of that was okay. I mean, most of it was okay. But now we have, through an increased awareness of psychology and an increased awareness of human interactions and conflicts, we have this idea that if their feelings get hurt, that something really bad is happening to them. And so now we're in this confusion because some things are bad. Some things do harm them. So where's the line? I think that we can kind of sit back and think about it from one perspective. A number of things kind of go through my mind as criteria for what's too much. If one kid is being picked on out of the group, you know, you see that one kid's getting scapegoated or whatever, I think it's appropriate to intervene and say, hey, guys, you know, this is not fair. And find some way to level the playing field a little bit with that kid. Also to look for patterns. Are there some kids that just consistently are stirring the pot in a negative way? Because usually in a group of kids, some of them will be more passive, some of them will be more aggressive. And to be able to take that kid aside and say, hey, dude, you know, I know you really want to play, and I know that you want to build the fort this way because you've got this idea in your head, but you're not the only one here. Let's talk about ways that you can include other people in making your plans. Now, so you can take apart some of the kids that are maybe stirring the pot a little bit more. So we can level the playing field if one kid's being picked up on. We can help kids to identify some of the attitudes that are contributing to the things that they're doing. And some of it, frankly, we can just ignore. We can just, you know, unless there's, you know, major blood, a lot of it we can ignore. Yes?
So you talked about before, like, sometimes to let the children work it out. So there's lots of times between my daughter and my son that I say, work it out. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not picking sides. I'm not doing this. And it does get to the point that they work it out. How do you make sure that they do still feel comfortable coming to you later when they can't work it out, i.e. bullying when they're, you know, 10 years old, 15 years old, and they don't, you know, you hear the stories about, I had no idea that this was even happening.
Right.
So how do you get that line of work it out, but I am still here to help you, but I'm not going to fix it for you? You know, like,
that is a great question. How do you, where's the line between work it out yourselves and you need to have the safety of knowing that I'm here for you? Okay, one thing I think about the work it out thing is that we used to have what we called rules of engagement, sort of like rules of warfare. And it was like things you were not allowed to do when you have these conflicts. One of them, you're not allowed to tell another child that they're stupid. You're not allowed to tell another child that they're ugly. And you're not allowed to tell another child that nobody loves them. Okay, or so-and-so doesn't love you, like your parents don't love you, or I don't love you. So we're not allowed to attack their acceptability, their